This interview was conducted on the 6th of February, 1974, between Lou DiDonato, the interviewer, and Captain Mike Lucas, the interviewee. The interview was conducted in the Army ROTC building on the campus of Youngstown State University. Mike, can you give us a little background about yourself before we start the interview here?
You want my service background?
Your service and a little bit about where you went to high school. And
well, I can start off by saying that I had an unusual background, mainly because of my parents. They were, my father was an Army officer himself. So I moved quite frequently from place to place and from continent to continent. Basically, I could start off with high school. I attended school in Germany, 2 years of high school in Germany. Upon completion there of my father's assignment there, he rotated as assigned Pentagon. So I went to school in Arlington, Virginia suburb, actually of Washington, D.C. And there I attended Wakefield Senior High School. It was my senior year. I graduated from Wakefield in 64, June of 64. From there, I came to Youngstown to attend, at that time, Youngstown University. It wasn't a state university yet. From 64 through 68, I attended the university here and participated in the ROT program. My interest in the service and in joining ROTC stemmed naturally from my home environment. My father being in the service, I naturally had an interest in it. After completion here of the course and obtaining my undergraduate degree, major in history, I then was assigned to the basic field artillery course at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I attended that course for approximately 9 months. At the end of that period, I was reassigned to another school, Fort Bliss, Texas. After spending approximately 5 months at that school, the Army sent me to another school, Fort Benning, Georgia, Ranger Training. Upon completion of that assignment, I finally was assigned to Germany. There I was assigned to the 4th Armored Division, whose headquarters at that time was in Nuremberg in southern Germany. I was assigned to a specific unit there, and I spent approximately 24 months in Germany. At that time I received my orders for Vietnam. I think that's about where we can drop that career thing off.
I wanted to ask you one question about the training, Mike. Do you have any say-so in the training you get? Do you volunteer for the branch you get, or?
Well, the way it works, when I was in ROTC, your junior, senior years, you are under a contract with the government. Your senior year, you select the branch that you're interested in. You have three choices. I selected field artillery and two others. Field artillery was my first choice. The request goes to Washington, D.C. And depending on where they need manpower, depending on your personal preference, they try to fit you into the branch you selected. Out of my class, since it was a heavy year for Vietnam, 68 was, after all, a very heavy year. A lot of us that selected what we call a combat branch, and field artillery is one, were granted that request. Others that selected what we call combat support branches, such as quartermaster, medical service, did not receive their choice, but were given a branch such as infantry or field artillery. Effective today, the branches that we get here at ROTC for the students are reflective of what they request. most of the ones we just got back recently did receive their first request, be it a combat branch or a combat support. So you can see how that's changing. It depends on the manpower needs of the service. And I think that's has to be understood that way. So there is some choice, degree of choice, as to what branch you want. That's the question.
Yeah. Mike, how long were you in the Army approximately now before you left for Vietnam?
Before I received my orders for Vietnam, I was in the service approximately 4 months.
Did you get any kind of specialized training to go to before you left Vietnam?
The only specialized training I received that you could consider oriented towards Vietnam would be the Ranger School I attended. It's an 8 weeks course. Originates at Fort Benning, Georgia, and you were trained there in the first phase. Then you go to Southern Tennessee and Northern Georgia into what they call a mountain phase, where you receive mountain training. And then you go your last phase, you go to Pensacola, Florida, where you receive training in amphibious operations in swamps, small patrol type situations, as you would encounter in Vietnam. So that would be the only training that I had prior to going to the similar nature of Vietnam.
Did you feel this was, you know, adequate training for what you were in?
I don't think you can adequately prepare yourself to go into combat. I don't care how long you prepare. It's something that it's hard to instruct for, but prepare one for. It's my opinion. I can say, right off the hand, I can say no. I was not adequately prepared for what I meant.
You were a captain, I assume, when you left.
I was just recently promoted to captain. I was sent to Vietnam.
Now, what part of the country did you serve in there in Vietnam?
I served in what they called I Corps, the area closest to the DMZ. I served with the 23rd Infantry Division.
You still were a field artillery officer?
I was a field artillery officer. My assignment there at Vietnam, I originally started out as what you call a fire support coordination officer with an infantry battalion. And what this encompasses is working hand in hand with the infantry battalion and coordinating all of the fires that they need for their operations, such as airstrikes, such as use of all the artillery in their area of operations, use of naval gunfire, perhaps be off the coast. All of this was handled through my job. If they wanted fire support, I had to get it for them. This is basically what it was. Now, that lasted for approximately 4 months. And after that time, I was assigned as a battery commander of a M-106 howitzer, so 105 caliber unit, that's six howitzers. And I spent my last 6 months, well, actually more than that, 8 months, as the commander of that unit.
What kind of reaction did you have when you got your orders assigning you to Vietnam?
Well, at the time, I wasn't really surprised because all my contemporaries were receiving them at the same time or had already left for Vietnam. So I wasn't amazed or shocked that I was going to go. I was sort of prepared to go psychologically. I knew that I was on the list, so to speak. So really there wasn't any shock or anything like that. It was from my family. But,
were you
expected.
Married?
I was married at that time.
In terms of being a benefit to your career now, does that help you then? To go to Vietnam or?
Well, at the time, being just promoted to captain, I had approximately another year left of my service agreement. As far as making the service my career, I was 50-50. I was not sure that I wanted to make it my career, even though my father had been in. So I really, if I can answer that question, because my feelings at that time. I could say now that more than likely it helped my career. After all, that's what your Army training is built around, actual combat situations. That's what you train for. Preparing for that particular event is all, that's what it's all about, ultimately. But as far as helping my career back then, I don't think I could honestly say that then that it would help my career. I was the last one that wanted to see orders from Vietnam. I knew that they were coming. I didn't ask for them. I didn't volunteer.
Did your service in Vietnam affect your decision to stay in the Army then?
Once I came back, I spent a year in Vietnam. Once I came back, I had pretty well determined by then that I was going to stay in the service for my 20 years. I had pretty well, after I discussed it with my wife, you know, we talked it over, I thought that I enjoyed the service, and I thought I'd make it a go. So.
We, most of us who didn't go, we're kind of interested in the type of things, you know, you did in your free time there. And, you know, what kind of life was life in the camp, the base, whatever?
When I went there, when I first arrived in Vietnam, this was in 1970, the time frame I'm speaking of, the units that I was associated with were initially in what they call a fire support base concept. And this means that some isolated hilltop or something, there perhaps would be three units on, and it'll be supposedly well fortified and connected by communications with another fire support base located somewhere else. And the units on that hill have operations off that fire support base. After approximately 4 months in that situation, we started moving once a week. In other words, there was no fixed base. We were always in a temporary type setup. As far as free time, I can honestly say the only free time I had was on my what they call R&R, rest and recuperation, that's what I call it. That's a 1 week, actually 6 days, that you leave Vietnam, and in my case, I selected Hawaii as my R&R site so I could meet my wife. She flew from the States. I met her there and spent 6 days with my wife. That was basically the only free time I ever had. The rest of the time, I was pretty much tied up with my job.
Is this the rule among most soldiers, the enlisted men, they only get R&R just one time?
Normally, I would say for the enlisted man in Vietnam, every effort was made to give them, they would see one R&R. Most of the time, I would say in 1970, they were receiving up to two R&Rs or two periods, if it was possible. The unit that I was with, most of the men, however, only received one.
R&R. Must have been pretty busy, huh?
Well, we were busy. We were, again, the designation as a combat unit as opposed to the combat support. The unit supporting, say, back in Saigon, Cam Ranh Bay, some of these huge logistical centers had more time, perhaps to, as you call it, free time, to maybe do other things.
Was there any kind of resentment among, say, your troops, of the troops that were in the rear that were involved in the conflict?
Naturally, I think there's going to be some kind of conflict as far as, well, I'm out here and Private Jones is back having a good time. But in the unit I was with, I really didn't see that much of a, it wasn't a morale problem, it did affect their job. The men I was with, I call them men between 18 and 21, did an outstanding job and never complained. There was no above normal amount of gripes or anything like that as far as that particular claim.
Were you a company commander at the...
Battery commander, same thing.
Yeah. What kind of rapport was there between you and most of the enlisted men?
Well, when you live with these people on a daily basis, you get a very good rapport. It's just like being part of the family. I mean, you're there 24 hours a day for a total year, and you get to know these people. I still correspond with some of my people.
What was your reaction? I'm not sure if Mili happened prior to you going over.
It happened prior.
What was your reaction to this, say, before you went to Vietnam and then after you came back?
Well, prior to going to Vietnam, my first reaction was, let's wait and see. The press automatically puts a large scandal show. I wasn't sure what was going on. I don't think anybody was. So instead of jumping to any kind of conclusion, I just said, let's wait and see what the facts are. An atrocity is an atrocity. In this case, the facts, I don't think, were clear enough to give a judgment at that time. I had heard from other sources, from other people that had been to Vietnam, that something like this might possibly happen. So there was the percentage that it may happen someday. After the trial or whatever we had here, Lieutenant Callie was found guilty. The only thing I can say is that the evidence presented shows the man guilty of the crimes they accused him of. He should be punished accordingly. There's no one, I don't think, can condone something like that. I can't myself. Nor would I condone it of anybody that worked for me. It's not, being in Vietnam was not anything that you would consider a nice time, but that doesn't give you the right to become God. If this is what happened, then you got to condone it. But my own personal feeling was that it should have been brought out. And I think it would have been a discredit to everybody if it had not been brought out.
How about, what was your reaction to all the peace demonstrations that were going on in the States at the time?
Well, my reaction was, as it always has been, that that's their choice, their way of showing their dissent with what our country is doing. It did not affect me in the least bit. As far as, say, on a university scale, I felt that perhaps, especially with reference to ROTC, which I'm a product of, I felt that they weren't really giving them a fair shake. The ROTC department naturally would be a key target for the people, you shouldn't call them militants, but the students that were displeased with what was going on with Vietnam. And this is a way to get publicity. This is a way to show how they feel about it. The problem areas that I saw, perhaps, is that some of the universities where the faculty started to support such activities. After all, I think, as far as the Army is concerned, that the officers, the majority of the officers in the Army are ROTC products, such as myself. And it is the university that has control over the student participating in the ROTC program. The Army itself doesn't have that larger influence over the average student at a university, even if he's enrolled in ROTC. So what I'm saying, in effect, is the fact that the liberal atmosphere you have at a university, if anything, will help produce an officer for the Army. It has that same feeling, with the exception of possibly the military academy. I think it's best that I think we keep it that way. I That's why I was a little bit upset or concerned about an attack on ROTC itself. If they do away with ROTC and all the universities, I think our Army is going to be, and our country, will be in a big hurt. That's my opinion.
What effect did these did you hear about the demonstrations when you were in Vietnam?
Oh, yes. You have access to a radio there. It is run by the Army and such, but the broadcasters such that they are pretty fair about it. They broadcast just about everything you get here off a local station. They say that the campus buildings at Rutgers have been seized by the dissidents and all this. And you wonder for a while, what's going on back home. And you get your home newspaper. I received, I received one from Florida and I received a Vindicator. I don't know if the Vindicator is a graded paper, but you read about it on the front pages and you discuss it amongst yourselves. But the fact is, it really didn't affect me that much, nor did it affect the men that much, except if it was made, perhaps if home was right nearby the campus or something like that. Again, this goes back to this philosophy I have about the liberal attitude on campus. Seeing itself produced again in the officer. It's a product of the university, not of the Army, of the university. ROTC doesn't get that much time up as far as your campus time.
When you were in Vietnam, did you see anything there that really bothered you about what we were doing or that... maybe it didn't bother you, but that you saw that we were being of some benefit to the Vietnamese at the time?
Well, the biggest complaint that I had while I was serving in Vietnam, that I was actually hampered from doing my job as a soldier, realizing that the Vietnam was a limited conflict. It was a political conflict more than anything else, I feel. And getting down on the level of a soldier in the field in Vietnam, he had to live with these political guidelines. Example, in 1970, in my area of operations, you were not allowed to fire at certain particular areas. That were designated by the Vietnamese and the military authorities as what they call no-fire areas. If the enemy were to use these logistical centers where they kept their supplies, which they did, you were still not allowed to fire into these areas. A lot of political intrigue going on that I was not aware of. The only thing I was aware of is they were using these sources of supply, and I was not allowed to fire into them. Little things like that sort of handicap and influence one's morale as far as trying to do your job and trying to keep your people alive. It's very aggravating not to be able to accomplish what you consider your mission. I think in a normal conflict, you would think that your mission would be to destroy the enemy. Well, in Vietnam, that was not the concept. The concept was a limited type operation, very strictly regulated by rules of engagement. And it was not a normal type of conventional war at all.
Who did you hold responsible for putting the guidelines out?
The guidelines?
Yeah.
For the war itself?
Uh-huh.
The basis, put it this way, the Army works for civilians. That's the way it's been set up in the Constitution. The Army does not make policy. Our government makes the policy. Army as the means of carrying out that policy. Now, I think in 1954, when first I started becoming more involved in Vietnam after the French fiasco, Dien Bien Phu there, the Viet Minh had thoroughly decimated the French, run them out. In comes the United States, and we were not totally aware, militarily speaking, of what we were getting involved in. We should have, possibly, militarily speaking, though, we should have learned the lesson of the French. That you're not going to isolate the enemy and stomp them out. Just won't happen that way. It still won't happen today. I think what happened was that as policy was being made, civilian policy, and we started to become more involved in Vietnam, I think the, and especially when the big escalation started in the after 64, the Kennedy administration, more troops were committed, more materiel was committed. The people in charge of the military at that time, the only thing that they could draw back on from experience was the Korean War. And, well, this is the way we fought the Korean War, therefore, this is the right way to fight the Vietnam conflict. And it just didn't work out. Then, after that initial influx of men and material, someone began to realize, well, hey, we've got a problem, a political problem, as well as a military problem. Initially, then they said, well, we'll start this pacification thing. The American soldier would fight the battles, and we'd take the Vietnamese soldier back and use him to pacify the immediate countryside around the larger population areas. Well, this is fine, except that all the Vietnamese can see is the fact that the Americans feel they can fight the battle themselves. And we don't want to be bought. You might screw us up if you try to help us fight your own battle. Well, that went wrong. That was the wrong approach. Finally, someone realized, hey, we got this conservancy thing. Everything was counterinsurgency. All sorts of money went into that program. Then somebody finally sat down. I don't know when this happened, but they realized that the Viet Cong infrastructure was not going to be isolated and removed until the Vietnamese themselves could stand on their own feet and do this themselves, fight their battles, and at the same time control the population. I hate to say this historically, but it's hard to try to fight any kind of war, any kind of conflict, if you don't have the support of the people. And this is one of the problems that you had in Vietnam. You didn't have the support of the people. People in the early stages, after being controlled by the French, and prior to that by the Japanese, and in comes the Americans now. So I think you can see how they felt. They just wanted to be left alone. But we didn't control the people, nor did the South Vietnamese government. So then you had this pacification thing where more and more of the Vietnamese were slated to take care of their own population and not worry about the fighting. The Americans would do the fighting. And you ran into the problem where we felt that the Americans didn't want their help, that the Americans felt they were in the way. But then in 68 and later on, when they started this Vietnamization program, where the Vietnamese started to assume more and more responsibility of the fighting. I think this was a good idea. I think it should have been done long before that.
Mike, as a
career officer, what effect did this war have upon the Army and its image to kind of bring out to the public?
Well, I think the only possible answer that the Vietnam, and I use the word conflict constantly because I didn't consider it. If you look at the part of the war, I think you had a different ballgame. The nice words they use are limited engagement, conflict. But it was not a conventional war, so I don't think you can really call it a Vietnam war. But anyway, getting back to the question, the only effect that Vietnam had as far as image was a definite negative type effect on the Army. We had this tendency after any kind of troop engagement, or especially over this long period of time, had a tendency to forget or want to forget, or to go into the term isolation. The Army itself received the negative image because the fact that the decisions made on Army level are the ones that make the difference. In other words, the casualty figures, the incidents such as in the knee line. First thing that the headline would say would be the Army this, the Army that, or the service, the Navy, this or that. On a policy level basis, the decisions were made, the higher policy level decisions were made by civilians, be it from the Pentagon under the regime of Mr. McNamara or whoever. These were civilians making these decisions. Now, granted, these decisions were enforced by military personnel, but the ultimate policy making is in the hands of the civilians, not the Army. In today's world, I think this is important as far as making the decision. There is no such thing, in my opinion, as a unilateral type decision in today's society. What is done in the United States has an effect throughout the world, not just to the American people. And I think this is possibly one of the main reasons why we became involved in Vietnam. Stating originally that we became involved in Vietnam because we were asked to become involved by South Vietnamese is true. However, we also became involved, and I think to be honest about it, we became involved because the policymakers at that time felt that it was very important that in order to match the other powers at the time, in order to keep up with the other powers, the term they use today is détente. If you want to apply it then, fine, but in order to just keep up with the other people powers, mainly Russia, we had to stay involved in the affairs of other countries. And it was not only Vietnam, if you remember that the Kennedy regime was also Cuba and also the Congo. These were small countries that we became involved with. So on those bases, I think that is possibly two reasons why we became involved initially in Vietnam. The request by the Vietnamese that we become involved, and secondly because it was to ours and quotation national interest to become involved. As we get back to the question, the negative image is still affected today. I think the volunteer army is part of that negative image. The draft is done away with, except now we have to register stuff. But the volunteer army, I think, is a part of that negative image, a result of Vietnam. People just became fed up, not with the policymakers, but with the army, because that's all they heard about, was army this, army that. Especially the younger generation, the ones that were involved. So I think it's an image that we have to live with. Especially since I'm in the service, I have to live with it. something that I really can't, I mean, I can't say about what's going to happen in the future. I don't have a crystal ball. But I think, my own opinion, I myself wish they would have kept the draft system alive instead of the whole after run.
When, you know, you talk about a long period of time when we were there. When you were there, did you ever think that our country was going to get out of there? Did you see any, you know, any light at the end of the tunnel in this?
Well, Jim Jones Moreland's famous comment about the light at the end of the tunnel. By the way, Jones Moreland was also the one who was instrumental in getting the volunteer army set up. He's now retired, by the way. So he doesn't have to live with those decisions. But as far as seeing any conclusion to the war, as I said back in the interview, fighting unlimited conflict with limited objectives, governed by strict parameters set by policymakers, I think the answer to that is yes, we will get out. But how we get out and with what we get out is the question. President Nixon said we have peace with honor. That's true, we do peace with honor. What else do we have? It's hard to listen. In my opinion, what else we have? Only history can tell. In my opinion, what we obtained in Vietnam.
When, I'm kind of interested in this one part here. Did you have much contact with the Vietnamese people themselves? I'm talking about the civilian people that we hear about in the villages. And
the only Vietnamese that I worked with were Vietnamese soldiers that we had a few operations with. Naturally, I do not speak their language, nor do most of them speak English. The officers that I associated with did speak English. Some of them very well. Of course, their officer system is somewhat different than ours. You know, sometimes they can buy visits and things like this. But the officers I worked with were fairly good at their jobs. But you have to remember, an officer there has been in combat probably since he's been born. So naturally, he's going to know his job as far as soldiering is concerned. And also, you have to realize that he knows I'm going home in 12 months, and you know where he's staying. He's staying right there. So you have to keep those two factors in mind. But the Vietnamese I associated with were very good people. They had no gripes about Americans, nor do I have any gripes about them. Well, we worked very well together.
What kind of soldier was the average Vietnamese soldier?
I can't honestly give you an answer on average Vietnamese soldier. I can only give you much gripes. The soldiers that I worked with, I would rate, in comparison to the American soldier, I would probably have to rate him somewhat lower. Again, this goes into the training program. I think perhaps the American soldier, first of all, is much better than his. And secondly, as far as motivation, Vietnamese, after fighting for that long period of time, I think he would become quite disgusted with the whole situation. I think they do have a problem there. I think the people are tired of fighting. They do fight year after year. I mean, you still can't read the paper, they're still fighting. And you begin to ask yourself, how do they do it? That was my first question. How would you like to be born and raised with the idea that you're going to be in combat practically every day of your life? Very, very discouraging. But the ones I started with were adequate.
How much actual combat were you involved in? Was it every day type thing, or?
Well, I would. It's hard to say how much combat. We were under enemy fire. We could have been under enemy fire on a daily basis. In other words, I was in an area. Well, you can say that about Vietnam. But, the area of operations I worked in, especially close to the DMZ. We were under enemy surveillance at least on a daily basis. And we did receive quite a bit of interest on a daily basis.
In light of all, you know, the experiences there and all this kind of thing, do you think our efforts there were worth the cost we paid?
Well, first of all, the cost we paid, I don't think can be evaluated. That's talking about men material.
And not only material, but also, like even to the image they earn.
Okay, the men and material image of Army, you can carry it so far as to the state of our society today. A lot of people blame the condition of our society on Dylan. That's true to some extent. I think a lot of it has been fabricated. I think Vietnam has been catch-all for, say, the last 10 years, last decade. Vietnam is blamed for everything from the racism, drug abuse, to the state of the economy. I don't believe a lot of that is true. It may be, and I think only history will tell it. I don't have the facts myself. Say with the one issue I do know, in my own area, drug abuse. People, the first thing when you say Vietnam, they say, well, there's a bunch of dope addicts, you know, coming back. They went over there clean and pure. Well, I think that's a bunch of nonsense. In my instance, I had several people that came to my unit from the States that were addicts, later identified as addicts. Not from Vietnam, but from the United States. Percentage-wise, in my unit, I had approximately 120 men in my unit. I would say, percentage-wise, maybe at the most, 10% were hard drug users. And when you consider how available it was in Vietnam, I think that's a pretty good statistic. And a lot of that also depended on personality weaknesses. Vietnam does not bring the best out in most individuals. You're a very harsh situation that you normally would not be put into in normal civilian life back here in Youngstown. And I think that's part of the picture. But blaming the drug abuse and the racism and the state of the economy of Vietnam, I think, has been a problem. It was Vietnam. I think there's other factors. A negative image, yes, I blame that on Vietnam. The Army is going to suffer from that for a long time to come. It's evident in the enrollment in the universities across the country. Here in Youngstown, we have 85 cadets. When I was going to school here in 1965, in that area, we had 450. Of course, part of that's due to the fact that the draft was then in existence, a way to avoid the draft, but to join ROTC. So that's why you had that large number. But the fact that it dropped so drastically is some kind of indication that the negative image is having its effect. Was it worth it? I say yes, myself. I personally couldn't say that we're going to cure all the social ills of the country of South Vietnam, but at least I think we've given them a start. We've given them an opportunity to make a decision. No, I cannot say that the present political regime is honest and crooked, but at least there is a present political regime there to make some kind of decision. The Vietnamese people have to decide now what they want to do with their leadership and direction. And I think it's important that the United States not get into this feeling of isolation, I should say. Get into the feeling of isolation, I think. Can't afford to. I think it's very important, in my own opinion, that we realize that national security rests not only reducing the number of our armed forces, but keeping them in parity with the other nations that we deal with. I don't think we can deal with the superpower nations on an equal footing if we don't keep our defense, or our, in this case, our army, up to strength. If you read the paper recently, I think it's evident the army is not meeting their quota as far as manpower. I think it's a serious problem. I think it's something that should be looked into before it's too late. I'm not pushing the panic button by any means, but I'm saying it's something that over a long period of time could develop into a quota crisis. That's the proper word.
Was Vietnam, do you think it was vital to our national security, our national defense?
Well, starting, again, you have to start in 1954. You had to ask the question then. That's when we really became involved. Was it then? I'm really not sure. As far as I get back to this thing about keeping this parity, or the détente, as they use the word day, you might perhaps say yes under that category alone. The thing with the domino theory, well, we have to stop the communist aggression in Vietnam before it spreads. You take that and look at it, and then taking the same idea, take the concept of diplomacy with other nation states now. How do you work diplomacy? Diplomacy is made between nations that know what you have backing you up. If we don't support, or if we don't have the support to back up decisions when we negotiate, then how can you say, be honest with yourself, that we're going to come out ahead of the game or come out even? I think it's something to look at. As far as national security, Vietnam is located in Southeast Asia, and we're located in the North American continent. Sometimes it's hard to understand why it's important for national security, but I think it is in the long run. And I do foresee some problems if people don't take seriously this problem of the reduction in our forces, a reduction in military budgets, a reduction in say, with the ABMs that I was talking about. I think people are naive if they think that the people in the world can exist without armies. That's my own philosophy. I think people are naive if they think that. And actually, that's a little bit biased there, because I am in the military. I do have my own philosophy. But to have a strong nation, I think you have to have a strong military. But what's good about this country is supposedly in order to control it by civilian policy makers. That's the way it should be.
What kind of, like you were talking about pacification and counterinsurgency programs and things like this, what kind of tactics did the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese use to try to win the support of the people there? Or weren't you that familiar with it?
Well, I can only, I'm not, I did not become that involved. Working with the civilian population, but from what I've read, my own opinions, and from what I saw how the army operated in Vietnam, the Viet Cong are organized rather sophisticatedly organized, and very effective. They have structure, they know where their commanders are, and the key to that is they do use force as a tool. If someone is in disagreement with them, they first would try talking, and then they will resort to force. Of course, the South Vietnamese do the same thing, I'm sure. But they fight on two different levels. They fight on a political level, indoctrination, and then they fight on a military level, such as you saw in Tet, 1968. The whole idea was to show South Vietnamese people their numbers, their strength, which they did. They also shocked a lot of Americans, a lot of the military in charge. Their objective is not city, it's not terrain, it's the people. It's what we finally realized with the parameters that we were given, that that was our objective, the people. And you're not going to win a campaign over there unless you control the people, unless the people believe you.
Now, we hear all kinds of stories about the draft, the was unhappy and all this kind of stuff. And he didn't want to be there, which we can all understand, but they, you know, he wouldn't make a good soldier. How were the, I'm sure your unit had a good percentage of draftees.
Well, I would say in my unit that 95% of my people were draftees. And I can honestly say that in my unit that I had probably some of the best soldiers that I've ever associated with. They did an outstanding job. I think history will show, not just mine, but I think the Army did their job in Vietnam, again, within the parameters that we had to work. I think, I feel that at least my unit did their job, that we were assigned, and the men did it in a very organized fashion. There was no morale problem. A man would put his 12 months in, he would go home. But for those 12 months, he did his job. He did very well.
What kind of problems did you have as a young officer coming into this environment, and you probably had older men, NCOs that had to take orders from you, or when you had younger men that had to look to you for leadership?
Well, I'll get to the problems in a second. I think the most important thing is going to Vietnam, I did have some experience with other troops in Germany and in a command position. Experience always helped. Second, I had confidence in myself, in my technical knowledge of my job. I knew what I was supposed to do. As far as talking to my NCOs who are much older, this is a non-commissioned officer's training to do a job. And he is trained to follow orders. And he's also trained to help officers. If they're not aware of what's right, technically, they'll quickly point it out. And in most cases, the NCOs are very helpful in other areas, such as personal problems, things like that. After all, they have emotions. I had no problems as far as that aspect.
Okay, well, I think just about wraps it up, Mike, and thanks a lot.
Yep.